This is Car Expert.
If you're not the cheapest, make sure it's good value. And I think that's maybe the challenge that Honda Australia faces moving forward.
It's not overly quick, but it doesn't need to be, because the whole idea of this vehicle is to provide incredible comfort in a ute.
JLR's now doing the same thing. They've just rolled it out in Australia. You've got an online ordering portal.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. Hello, Paul Marrick, or stranger.
No, just call me Daddy.
Oh, my God.
Hello, James Wong.
Hi. That's not how I wanted to start this episode, but...
Oh, I was going to say, it's James already calls me that, so there's probably no joke in that.
Well, we probably should explain this for anyone that doesn't know. Paul, you're now a father. And yes. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mandy. Beautiful baby girl. Her name is Frankie. She keeps us up at night, but she's very cute and cuddly, and we love her loads. Yep. She likes to hang by my collection of Commodores, because it'll be her inheritance one day. Just kidding.
She has no pain, does she?
Absolutely not.
I'd be interested to see, once she grows a little bit older, what she thinks of your dad jokes, because you were saying dad jokes long before you were a dad.
Yes, I have been practicing them for about 10 to 15 years now. Yes. So I have perfected the art of the dad joke, and I really hope that she can appreciate them.
Now, some really cool news this week for Car Expert Paul. We broke the 100,000 YouTube subscribers not long ago, and it's actually official now, because we have a plaque from YouTube to say that.
Yes, I'm looking at the plaque now. It's this lovely shiny thing. It's got a mirror in it, and it says, presented to carexpert.com.au for passing 100,000 subscribers. Thanks, YouTube. So that's exciting news, because we passed the 100,000 subscriber mark just before the channel hit 1 year old. So the growth has been phenomenal. We're currently the most watched automotive review channel in Australia, which, again, is exciting for our age. We're getting just under 2 million views a month, a little over 10 million watched minutes a month as well. So we absolutely love it, and we love hearing from everyone. So some of the feedback that we get on our videos, and I literally read every single comment pretty much, we take that feedback on board and adjust our videos as we go. So we love sort of the community being part of it all. And if ever you do see something that you think we should change, feel free to let us know. Doesn't mean that we will change it, but we will take that feedback on board, because, you know, we want just a better viewing experience for everyone.
Have you found how many viewers are from Australia and international?
Yeah, most of our viewers are from Australia. Depending on the video, we'll get a spike in viewers from other countries. But for the most part, most of our viewers come from Australia, which is really encouraging, because it means that the car market's healthy here at the moment. And it also means that I guess we're getting the right type of people watching our videos, because it is a bit irrelevant to watch a video here that perhaps mentions stuff that isn't relevant to your market. So it sort of makes sense that most of our viewers are from Australia, but it is good to see just a really nice cross-section.
Do you know which video has the most views since launch?
Yeah, good question. I think
it's the Nissan Navara. I'm looking at it right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got 648,000 views and counting. Yeah.
Why so many for the Navara?
Well, look, whenever we get a global reveal of a car, whenever we're there the first to get a video out, we generally tend to be the best at it. So we just provide enough detail for people that want to see more about this new model. So we just keep sort of plugging away with that same formula. People love our drag comparisons as well, where we sort of tee up cars against each other and take them down the drag strip. But we're also doing a lot of explainer videos now that are doing really well. I think our video on four-wheel drive modes explained has just under 500,000 views. And it's a video that a lot of people watch and go, oh, I wish I had just watched this before I went off-roading and got stuck. It's a pretty straightforward video, and that's what we try and do. We try and explain stuff that I think is assumed knowledge, but to a lot of people it is actually not knowledge at all.
Yeah, absolutely. A bit of an update on the Car Expert Experience Centre. It's now closed. Hopefully we're going to have a few more pop up in the very near future? Because the one in Sydney was just a bit of a tester, wasn't it? Just to test the waters.
Yeah. Yeah, so we opened our pilot store just over 3 months ago in Sydney. It was at the Westfield Warringah Mall on the northern beaches. The whole concept of it was to do a 12-week pilot to see whether people would actually like the concept of coming to a place where there's no sales pressure, no one's trying to force you into buying anything. We're just there to give you advice on new cars and also to give you an opportunity to test drive all the cars that we had on the floor as well. We were blown away with how successful it was. We had just over 32,000 visitors come through the doors. The data we have is incredible. And what we've been able to do with the data is actually change the way we write reviews. So a lot of the questions that people would come in with were not questions that we were really answering in our reviews. So now we know the stuff that we need to include in there so that, that real car buyers can actually be serviced. We were able to have real conversations with people that were in the market, and some of the feedback that we got was excellent. Some of the people that actually went and bought cars after visiting, getting advice from us and test driving was really cool. And yeah, the next step is going to be another store in Sydney, where we're currently in the final stages of selecting the next site in Sydney. And that will then be followed by a store in Melbourne as well. So hopefully before the year's end, we'll have both of those up and running. And we'll be implementing the stuff that we learned from the pilot to make sure that it all runs smoothly and people enjoy their visit.
What were one of the questions that people asked that took you by surprise and that you are going to implement into reviews, or is that still a secret?
No, it's not a secret. It's funny. Almost every single person I spoke to, the first question they had after I sort of gave them the spiel on the car they were looking at was, what colours does it come in? And
really?
I mean, it's crazy. We always mention it in our YouTube videos because someone actually said in our video, oh, can you tell me what colours they come in? But we realise that in person, everyone wants to know that. And something as small as that was something we weren't including in our reviews and something that we're now sort of starting to include. So, I don't know. It shows you that real car buyers aren't necessarily the type that care about handling and performance and stuff like that. I mean, the Renault Captur was one of the most popular cars at the Experience Centre, and it's a car that traditionally, you know, doesn't really do that well in terms of attention. And it was incredible to see just how many people saw the value in that car when it was parked next to something like a Kona. So I think it's really good to see that people are engaging with that concept and can really see the value in it all.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. I'm so glad it worked out in the end. Okay, well, we might get stuck into this week's news. We'll start with you, Paul. The Honda price promise has been revealed ahead of the agency switch. What is this all about?
Okay, so Honda has announced that it's, we already knew that Honda was switching to an agency model, which means that the price of cars across the country would be the same. There'd be no haggling and that would be that. But they've now announced how it plans to price its cars after it does that switch on July 1. It's introduced a couple of things. So first up is fixed pricing on servicing, and it'll see that the fixed pricing that comes with a car will also come with the first five services costing $125, which is actually really good value when you consider how expensive servicing can be with some brands. And in most cases, that's going to cover you for 5 years of driving because servicing occurs every 12 months and 10,000 kilometers. In most Honda products, with the exception being the Odyssey, for example, which is 6 months service intervals. But they've also revealed the pricing of the entire range. And I don't know, I get the concept of the fixed pricing, and that's great. The problem with doing it is that when you go down that path, you kind of open yourself up to competition. And with so many competitors in the segments that Honda is in, you have the opportunity to haggle with everyone else except Honda. So I'll be interested to see how this works for them and whether people who were always going to buy a Honda still buy a Honda, and whether this will actually help them conquest people to the brand or whether it will turn people away from them. J-Wo, what do you think about the pricing? Do you think it's on the higher end, especially at 57 grand for the Accord starting price?
This was an interesting story to read and to see what their strategy is, because obviously they've been quite upfront about it for a little while. I did a quick cross-check between some of the current pricing and then the new pricing that they've announced, and a lot of them have actually gotten more expensive marginally, at least compared to Victorian driveway pricing. So I found that a little bit odd. I think what might be the case, though, is that while this model looks a little bit weird, or at least the pricing structure looks a bit strange for the current range, given where the cars have progressively gotten more expensive, which seems to be the case with the current climate anyway, I think it might be sort of they're laying the foundations for the next generation of products. So, like, you know, we've got the new Civic coming very soon, new HRV and things like that. So if that's around the price points of the next generation stuff that's more advanced, much better quality, you know, better engines and all that kind of stuff, I guess that's a good thing. And then maybe having a direct sales model as well means that there's less conflict between, you know, dealers, distributors, all that kind of stuff. And then they can have direct conversations with head office about, you know, sourcing the best cars that Honda offers globally. Because I think a lot of, you know, Civic, for example, will start being sourced from, I think, Japan, maybe not Thailand anymore. And that might be the case for a couple of other model lines. So it just sort of depends on what happens moving forward. Because I think a lot of people aren't blind to where a lot of these cars come from now. And if you're charging a premium for, say, a Thai-made product, there's a perception that it's not as good as a Japanese one. So if they start making those changes and sort of a bit more upfront with where cars come from, and, you know, they have all the features that from rival brands, for example. I don't think people are averse to spending money. I think they just want to get bang for buck. So if you're not the cheapest, make sure it's good value. And I think that's maybe the challenge that Honda Australia faces moving forward.
Paul, are you a bit of a haggler?
So I am, because I am a tiny bit of a tight ass. But the problem is I inherited haggling from my dad, and my dad he has a very strong accent, a strong Eastern European accent, and he gets very aggressive when he haggles. And what I found growing up is that it doesn't work for him, and it still doesn't work for me either. So when we go out to buy something, I let my wife do the haggling because she kills them with kindness, and I just stand back and reap the rewards.
So in other words, you don't mind a fixed price on the car because you didn't have to bother with the haggling.
Yes, exactly.
Fair enough. Okay, I'm pretty excited to see that the 2022 Porsche 911 Carrera GTS is coming to Australia in manual form, J-Wo, and I reckon you'd be happy about this too.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest Porsche guy, but for some reason, in every single Porsche model line, the GTS tends to be my favorite. So yes, the most powerful mainstream 911 model, the GTS, has been revealed ahead of an early 2022 arrival in Australia. There's a few different models in the GTS lineup, and it'll also be the only 911 variant that isn't a GT3 that offers a manual transmission. So a turbocharged flat six engine sits in the rear. It's got 353 kilowatts of power and 570 newton meters of torque, which is 22 kilowatts and 40 newton meters more than the Carrera S. It'll hit 100 kilometers an hour from a standstill in just 3.3 seconds when it's fitted with all-wheel drive. And the eight-speed dual-clutch PDK transmission. I'd attempt to say the German name, but I think Scott will do a much better job of doing that than I can. It also rides on a sport chassis that's 10 millimeters lower than stock, and it's not like the standard 911 is not low or not sporty already. But it also gets the adaptive Porsche active suspension management, or PASM, as standard. So it'll be offered in coupe, cabriolet, and targa guises. I think for me, the targa is my pick. What about you guys? Which is your favorite 911 GTS body?
This is funny. So we weren't talking specifically about GTS last week's podcast, but we were talking about our favorite variant in the 911 range. And I also said the Targa as well, J-Wo.
Yeah, I just love that metal ring that they have. And the latest ones that have that really cool opening mechanism where it's almost like a helmet that sort of lifts up and then descends into the boot area and then comes back. I just think it's so cool.
Yep. So much.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah, I love the thought of a GTS. It's like the perfect middle ground. You know what I mean? I think it's just where it needs to be.
The 911 GTI.
Lol.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice? With the price of a Golf GTI, please.
Speaking of price, I nearly forgot that. The base, and I use the term base very loosely, the base 911 GTS Coupe will start at $314,800. And if you want all-wheel drive in the form of the 911 4, it'll be $334,000. So almost a 20 grand impost for all-wheel drive. The Cabriolet will start at 340,000. 7,700. And then the Targa is all-wheel drive only and 366,900. So it'll cost a pretty penny. That's almost 10 GTIs. I don't know why I keep drawing the GTI comparison, but I guess you can get tartan cloth in both.
And they're very long-distant cousins in some weird way. So
yeah, you can say that.
Still,
yeah.
Still Paul, Jaguar Land Rover are joining many other brands who are starting to sell cars online.
Yeah, selling, I mean, we all buy things online. It's not really too, too strange. JLR's now doing the same thing. They've just rolled it out in Australia. You've got an online ordering portal, shows you where the stock is, how much it costs, and allows you to reserve the vehicle as well. Works for new, demonstrator, and approved used cars as well, which I think is a good thing. This sort of goes down that path of not being able to really haggle like you could if you did it in person. Yes, you can make an inquiry and try and sort of haggle through there, but what they do is to try and take the edge off it. The price includes 12 months rego, the CTP if it applies, delivery charges, stamp duty, blah, blah, blah. So it is all there. And then once you've reserved the vehicle, you can actually you can see which cars are under offer. And I think you will have the ability, I think, if push came to shove, to try and drive those prices down. But I'd be curious to see how this works for them, because it works for Tesla because you don't have a choice. Everything is priced the same and that is how you buy the car. When you do offer online sales, you kind of have to remove the ability to haggle for this to work. So if you still allow people to buy it at a dealer, why would you then go and buy it online? I don't really see how that's going to work. I think these guys will allow you to sort of drive the price down if you need to, and I think that works. It also means that if you see the exact spec that you want, you can pay a $1,000 deposit. They'll reserve the car, and it means it's not going to get sold from under you. So, yeah, I think that's probably a smart way of doing it. You just need to have a think about how the price is actually going to get settled.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, and lastly, some more Honda news, JWO. The 2022 Honda Civic Hatch has been revealed. It's going to be here later in the year.
Yeah, so we sort of touched on Honda already, and I mentioned the new Civic Hatch. So we're not getting the sedan anymore. We're just getting the hatch, and it basically gets the sedan look from the B-pillar forward. So it's like a flatter, squarer design, and much less busy than the current one. And then the rear is still sort of like a fastback look, but it's nowhere near as polarizing. I think instead of copying some like medieval war mask or whatever, they've decided to copy the Kia Stinger instead, which is a pretty safe move. It looks quite nice. And it's got like a new light signature. So it's kind of revolutionary and evolutionary in that the overall execution is still fairly similar, but it's been brought into it. It's much more conservative and less out there, I guess. Very clean design. The interior has been updated quite comprehensively. There's a new digital driver's cluster, a new infotainment system, a really simple horizontal dashboard design that sort of harks back to the Honda E and some of their more retro-inspired designs. So they've also cut back on buttons and all that kind of stuff, which is very in keeping with what's going on in the industry right now. So the Australian model will launch at the end of this year, and will initially get a new version of the current model's 1.5-litre turbocharged four-cylinder petrol engine. Specs haven't been confirmed yet, but I imagine that given the current one already makes 127 kilowatts and 220 newton meters, we might get one that's closer to maybe 134 kilowatts and 239 newton meters like they have in the US. And I believe that's also the same tune that's in the current CR-V. But possibly even bigger news is that Honda has actually confirmed a hybrid version, which will join the lineup globally and in Australia sometime in 2022. They haven't actually detailed specs for that either, but the closest clue that we have at the moment is that the all-new HR-V, which was revealed globally a couple of months ago, gets a 1.5-litre four-cylinder petrol engine with two electric motors, and quotes outputs of 96 kilowatts and 253 newton meters. So those specs alone are pretty in line with what, say, the Toyota Corolla hybrid offers. I think, like we were talking about before with the pricing structure of the current lineup, it'll depend on whether Honda offers the hybrid as a standalone variant like it used to, which didn't really work well because it was a very expensive top-of-the-range variant. or offering it as a powertrain option across several different trim levels, because I think that's where Toyota's really found success, not just with the Corolla, but with RAV4, Camry, I'm sure Kluger, CHR will be the same, is that having it as a relatively affordable option on multiple trim levels means that a whole different range of buyers can get into electrification at a more affordable price. So if the current Civic starts at about 30 grand drive away, if you can get a base Civic with hybrid for like 32,500 drive away, I think they'd be onto something there, but we'll have to wait and see, because it's still, 6 to 12 months away from being in the market. So exciting stuff for Honda. I hope it's as good as they say it is, and I'm keen to actually get a drive of it because it looks kind of cool.
I'm actually a bit more of a fan of the sedan, like the current model at the moment. I love that sedan way more than the hatch. And I don't know about the new hatch. You know what it reminds me of? The side profile of a 6 Series GT. It's just got that
flat
back on it. Oh. I don't know whether I'm a fan of the hatch.
No, I think it's a bit more resolved than that.
It probably is. Yeah.
I think it looks silly. It has like a massive forehead. Like it's sort of, it looks weird.
With like an overbite or something. Like
yes, exactly.
I don't know.
It's a no from me.
Well, let us know. podcast@carexpert.com.au. Are we right or are we wrong? Hello, Tony Crawford.
Hello, Mandy. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
And everyone else.
You've been driving the very edgy looking Hyundai Sonata N-Line. What do you think of that edgy styling, by the way?
Well, I really, this is a car, the looks department, this thing looks $1 million. I mean, it is just, as you said, cutting edge. The LED light thing system on the front where it goes halfway up the car is amazing. And the rear tail lights with that light strip or light saber across the back, a la Porsche, I think is brilliant. This is gonna, I mean, I said in my review, which will be out by the time this podcast goes to air, that why would you launch, as good as this car looks and pretty much is, why would you launch a mid-size to large, because it is almost a large car, it's 4.9 meters long, why would you launch this in a very tiny market like Australia, where sedan sales are tanking and have been tanking for several years? And you got to ask yourself, why would you want to launch a car like this in Australia, where and they're only launching, it's a top model, essentially, that we drove, the N line, and that's obviously going to be relevant to even less people than the standard. Standard Sonata. So, but it in all fairness, it looks great, and it would kind of have me thinking about, would I, should I go an SUV, or is this a much better proposition? As I said, we drove the 2013 kilowatt 422 newton meters of torque. It's got some punch, this, and we all know that Hyundai produces these full strength N cars. But this is not a full-strength N car, and yet it goes pretty close to it with that sort of output and the way this thing hustles along. It's very quick. We didn't get any they didn't claim any figures, and we didn't get any figures. I was scrolling through US road tests to find out what they'd got 0 to 60s in, and some of them were down to 5 seconds. 0 to 60. So if you figured 5.3, 5.4, that's probably being even, that's probably being less generous. It's probably less than that. But this thing hurries along, and it's Alcantara. Yeah, everywhere you look, there's some good stuff about this car. Alcantara seating, great screen, great infotainment, full-size instrument display, digital. Great engine, by the way, hooked up to 8-speed dual clutch, which I believe, and you guys might know more than me on this, is the same dual clutch gearbox that the i30N gets, albeit perhaps differently calibrated. I'm not sure how the calibration works. I think N gets its own calibration, of course. But this thing, as I said, I was amazed how quick this thing was. Not entirely off the mark, but mid-range punch through some twisties that we drove at, some B-road twisties. It was very impressive. However, and I did say this in my review, it has a fair degree of torque steer if you give it a good boot. And I don't know how long we have not – I've not talked about torque steer for it seems like a long time. I haven't had to talk about torque steer because many manufacturers, most manufacturers have got that predicament under control, that thing under control. These guys haven't with this car.
How does it go with launch control then?
I didn't try launch control. We were on public roads, and we just didn't get the chance to do a launch control. I'm not a great fan of launch control systems. I think they're pretty much irrelevant for public road use. I mean, why would you want to launch your car off at – where are you going to do that? The stoplights, or are you going to do that in your driveway? I don't know, like where you would actually do that. But
industrial estate at nighttime.
I guess. And well, I do hear those people down the road from me. I'm not one of them. I just think as a package, this car pretty much does a lot of stuff well. And I did say in my review that apart from the Octavia RS, that's probably its closest rival, I would say. And that'd be a hard choice to pick, although I'd probably rate the RS as a driver's car, even though it's not as quick. I would say the RS for me would be more fun behind the wheel than this. A better feel,
All right, so with the Sonata, so you're looking at what price is that? That's $59.90 before on-road costs. For just about $2,000 more, $2,000 to $3,000 more, you can get a Kia Stinger 330S. Not as many luxury goodies as this, but rear-wheel drive. What would you rather have for that kind of money?
Oh, man. I was on the original launch of that Stinger. I drove those cars flat out on B roads, I think in Victoria, perhaps, several years ago. One of my favorite cars. So I would have to say I'd probably go the Stinger before the Sonata.
You make a really good point as well about bringing a large-ish sedan into a market that is just completely turning away from largest sedans. My understanding is the Sonata was originally supposed to be here almost 2 years ago, because it's been out in the US for quite a while, and we were supposed to get a full range of naturally aspirated petrol, and there's a smaller 1.6-litre turbo petrol model that we're supposed to get as well. There's a hybrid available overseas. So evidently Hyundai has decided, well, you know, this range is not going to sell in large numbers, so let's just bring in the most interesting one. Do you think that that is a good strategy for them to have followed?
I did. I just talked to Hyundai and I asked them that same question, that why would you bring that car in here? And he said, well, the combination of the ultra-modern styling, the cutting-edge tech, performance-tuned drivetrain was, something too good to refuse was their comment. So I get that. This is a nice package, but like you said, you've got Stinger, you've got Octavia RS, you've got you've got two rivals there that might outdrive this. I don't think they're as modern or they offer as much space. Well, I guess the Octavia would, even in its five-door, hatchback version. But, I don't know, guys. I can't answer that question of why they would do that. I guess it was on the menu and it was easy to take and with only having to worry about one spec, one variant, makes it a pretty easy proposition for them. And I guess it's something to build their N-line portfolio. That's another thing they're trying to build in Australia. And it's not a bad car. It's a good thing. It'll work for a lot of people out there that aren't sold on the SUV thing, that maybe commuting to work each day and don't really want an SUV because they've already got one in the garage and their wife drives it for school pickups and all the rest of it. So I get it. If an executive or even a private buyer likes something with a bit more pep than a Camry, because Camry really can't offer anything that competes with this vehicle.
I think what I find most interesting about this segment is, one, we've seen this mass exodus. We've seen Ford and Kia leave it in this market, among other brands. But what we're seeing with the latest generation of mid-sized to largest sedans is increasingly sleek, kind of four-door coupe-esque styling, because automakers are thinking, well, sedans are a declining market, so let's make them as interesting as possible. But then don't you think, Croft, that maybe that just invites another problem, because perhaps the reason people have been moving away from sedans is they want a more practical, more upright, more easy to access SUV. So if you make what few sedans are left sleeker and sleeker, you're just further alienating people that are already leaving sedans?
Yes, but on the other hand, at the moment, Hyundai doesn't offer something in their SUV range with this kind of performance in that size. So until Tucson becomes an N line, does Tucson have an N line right now?
It will do very shortly, but it won't have a more powerful engine at this stage.
Yeah, so look, I think this is probably tuned to deliver quite a bit of excitement behind the wheel. Let me just say that I wanted to like this car probably more than I ended up liking it. And I was really, you know, when I got on the throttle, we were on some really cool twisty roads, and there was a bit of torque steer, and maybe the transmission wasn't shifting exactly how I wanted it to, and I kept flicking between auto and paddle shifters and couldn't quite find the exact type of driving situation that I really wanted to get out of this car. And that's not the same with the Octavia. I found that love, and I dare say Stinger. I haven't driven a recent one in some time, but back when I did drive the launch twin turbo 6, I really loved it and the way it drove. I didn't get that feeling. I felt a little bit disconnected from this car, not in the way that I felt with Octavia and Stinger. So in that respect, it probably wasn't as much fun as I was thinking it was going to be. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. You could ask the same question of why you didn't just go all the way and produce a full-strength N version of Sonata. I
think the really natural rival for this car, when it actually comes to Australia, will be the updated Volkswagen Arteon. Mm. It's going to be a bit more expensive, I would expect, but if they can get that car to us at a reasonable price, those two are quite similar in the fact they're both big, sleek, four-door sort of lift-back sedans. Also, Will, on your point earlier, I think what we've already seen with wagons is that they are now enthusiast cars, and for the most part, unless you're talking about a Camry, sedans are the same. So why not make them interesting? I think if you make a sedan practical, it could cure cancer and people still wouldn't buy it. They're that turned off by them at this point. So I see very little sort of drawback to just making them as interesting as possible and letting the enthusiasts have their fun.
I'd be very curious to hear what y'all think about the Kia K5, the Optima replacement we're not getting here, because under the skin it's related to the Sonata. I'm wondering, if we took a straw poll, which model people would find more attractive, the Sonata or the K5, because that K5 is a looker.
We might have to put a slider on the podcast post and let people work it out for themselves in the comments.
Oh, there we go. Good idea.
Do you guys think $59.90 plus on roads is a fair price?
It's loaded. It's absolutely
fully
loaded.
There is nothing. I don't believe there's a single option except paint, which is $500.
I just don't really know who is going to buy it. Like, for me, if you have this much power, I want rear wheel drive, or I want something European like an Octavia. So yes, this is a really good value for money car, but for a very, very, very small niche of people.
I think I said in my review, without going back into it, that if there was an all-wheel drive version of this, I think I'd be right into it.
Yeah.
I
would say around that 50 grand mark. I mean, for one, Hyundai now has a car that people can grow up from. If you've got an i30N, but you've also got a family, and you want a performance car or something interesting, the Sonata is now an option for you. It's still got a bit of that raggedness. It's still front-wheel drive, but it is bigger and more stylish. I'd also argue that around that 50 grand mark, there are people coming out of things like Golf R's or, to a lesser extent, Civic Type R's. They're a bit more expensive and a bit more focused. that maybe don't want another hot hatch or want something a bit more grown up but still want to feel like they're young and interesting and fast. So I actually think the Sonata is probably going to find favor with that sort of person who might previously have had a hot hatch and still wants to be interesting and young and a bit, you know, different, but wants something a bit more grown up. So I think around that price point, that could be who they're targeting.
I mean, wrapping it up, there's a lot, there's so much to like about this car. You're going to buy it, you're going to buy it off looks, number one. It's a sensational looking car. It's loaded, as you said, Will, to the hilt with kit. It gets everything and the kitchen sink, as far as I'm concerned, and it's relatively cheap to own. And I say it stacks up as a purchase price with all its rivals, meaning the Octavia and the Stinger. And, you know, it's Hyundai, right? They, you know, it's the head of engineering is Albert Biermann. So, he, you know, overall, he would have had a hand in this thing, which is why it goes probably better than what people think in terms of its outright performance. It's just me. I didn't quite connect with this car in the same way that I thought I might, because after driving their i30N DCT, which is an incredible car, and the i20N, which we all know I've driven as well, I mean, this is not that. In fairness, it's not a full-end car either, but I think I was expecting more, and I got about 85 to 90% there, not quite the whole way.
All right, Corf, so you gave the Sonata a car expert rating of 8.4. Now, while we've got you, let's go the complete opposite end of the scale and talk trucks or pickups or utes or whatever. The Ram 1500 is one mighty beast. You reviewed this one. Did it feel big and every bit American as you would expect?
It's a truck. There's no two ways about it. It's a freaking big truck. And, the only truck I've ever driven before this was back in my teenage years, and the old man had a wheat farm, and I was charged with driving the 10-ton Foden wheat truck from the fields to the silos and line up with the swearing country folk that who used every second word the F-bomb. And this was my indoctrination into trucks. And I did that for a month for $200. That's what he used to pay us, the old boy. And it was 5 till 5, 12-hour shifts. And anyway, so that was a long time ago. So to get back into something I guess of similar size, because this thing's virtually 6 meters long, 2.4 plus meters wide with these gigantic side mirrors. They are the biggest side mirrors, but they have sort of wing. They have sort of a extension arm that looks much like a 288 GTO Ferrari. It's that long. And then you've got a giant mirror on top of this that's the size of a wall mirror in a house. It's just giant. And I thought it would be massive and just ridiculously big. And, you know, my question was, who's buying these things? But believe it or not, they're Atico who and Holden Special Vehicles who do the conversion in Victoria, they're gunning for 6,000 of these. They're going to sell, they're confident of selling 6,000 this year with a view to increasing that to 10,000 over the next 2 years. Yeah, 10,000 Aussies out there are going to be paying anywhere for the new version, which this is. Remember the old version, I get mixed up, but I think this is the DT. And the old one was the DS. And the DT is a marked improvement interior-wise and generally speaking. This reminded me, and anyone that I took for a ride in this truck said, man, this is the Rolls-Royce of utes, and it really is. It is absolute armchair comfort. You sit back with that 5.7-litre V8, naturally aspirated, and it just cruises. It's not overly quick, but it doesn't need to be, because the whole idea of this vehicle is to provide incredible comfort in a ute for not only front and front driver and passenger, but the rear seat passengers have as much room as a Mercedes S-Class Extended. That's how much room there is in the back of this thing. It's absolutely incredible. And every feature under the sun with the new DT series. And I was pleasantly surprised, you know, when you walk up to this thing, obviously it's a proximity and the footrest, the sidestep, automatic sidesteps pop out. And you need that too if you're as short as me, because you won't be reaching that the cabin without that sidestep. And it's retractable, of course, and then as soon as you close the door, it retracts back in. Stuff like that. It's all very cool. The rear tailgate is actually auto and it's powered. So it's absolutely no effort. Mandy, even you could get that tailgate open.
Awesome.
On this big truck. And certainly J-Wo could too. I know he's light-wristed, but he could definitely get that tail.
Wow.
No, he's got quite strong wrists.
See, okay.
The other reason Croft is so strong is because he's been driving the Model T since birth. Right. No power steering, please.
It was his first car.
I thought that would have been his first introduction into truck driving.
No, Model
T ute.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, the comfort is amazing. Believe it or not, I drove it around for a week and I didn't hold back on where I went. I didn't plan my trips anywhere. I parked it everywhere I went. That was to a Mossman French patisserie, to the beach for a surf in Manly, to a restaurant in the city. And, of course, you can park in a loading zone. So there are plenty of parking opportunities for a vehicle of this size without much planning. So they're not as impractical as you might think. And but they are expensive, about $139.9 for the DT, this particular top spec edition, the limited. And you do get everything. You get a lot of safety kit as well, all the latest active safety kit from rear cross traffic alert and basically everything on the menu of any other luxury car. So, you know, you don't miss out on much. And I guess for $139,000 plus on roads, might seem expensive initially, but when you sort of mirror that with a luxury car with that much carrying capacity and, of course, the towing capacity, I mean, this is rated at, Paul, you might be able to help me on this one. I think it's 4,500 kilos.
It depends on the tow bar. So with a standard tow bar, it's 3.5 tons, but you can, with some of these, get a pintle. And I think you can also do fifth wheel on some of them as well that increases the towing capacity.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of people might use that to tow very large caravans and luxury caravans. Certainly I saw instances of that. And so, yeah, but why not? Obviously, you're not going to have one if you live in the city, but if you live sort of, you know, within sort of, you know, 15, 20 Ks of the metropolitan city, I think they make quite good use, and I don't really find them overly expensive, because I mean $139,000 in luxury Audi land or Mercedes or BMW doesn't really buy you a whole lot, and consider the tray size and the fantastic ingenious thing they're called the Ram Box, which you can basically gate the entire length of the tray if you want off, or you can move that tray around within a couple of minutes, really. That's all it took me. And the auto power tailgate. You've also got these two things on the side, which is part of the Ram Box, which you can store a beer, grog, ice, whatever you want, and they consume quite a lot. I think it's about 112 litres each, 115. And you can just hose them out because they've got a plug in the bottom. I suppose you could put live fish if you're a fisherman in there and bring it home and drive them home. And
Tony, could you store candles in there? Perhaps
you could store plenty of wax candles, Paul. And
just for anyone listening, the joke to this is that Tony lives in Sydney, and currently we're looking at him on the screen in complete darkness with candles on because he has no electricity, and he's in lockdown.
Yeah, he looks like a Harry Potter professor at the moment.
Well, that's actually a compliment.
Yeah, I forgot to mention the part where you look like Professor McGonagall.
I don't know what that means, but if it's offensive, I find it funny.
I
reckon they're fantastic. I've spent a lot of time in the States, and especially in Texas. I love the fact that in Texas, you've got versions of these big utes, like the Lone Star Edition, that is literally just built for Texas. They drive these day in, day out, and something the size of this is considered tiny compared to some of the dualies that they're driving and stuff. And I think that in Australia, people think that these are too big for our roads, but the 1500 is only really marginally bigger than some of the dual cab utes we already have. And the dual cab utes we already have are quite narrow simply to meet the tax requirements that they have. If you actually look at the length of them, a lot of them are pretty much this length anyway once you stick tow bars on them. So,
The Gladiator is easily this long. And don't forget, you know, everything's electronic on the car. Like, it really is. There's more luxury in this than most Audis at 139 grand, if I can say that. So, yeah, they're not overly expensive. That's my take on these things. And they look fantastic. I mean, that grill is as tall as a mountain. I mean, it is just enormous. And, I mean, people do get out of your way. I certainly wasn't driving around with that in mind, but you come up behind someone and you want to change lanes, mate, they'll let you through, no problem. You know, away you go, sir. And don't forget, this is the baby. The 2500 and the 3500 versions, they're even bigger. They're monsters. So Paul's right. This is the baby, and I find them quite practical enough. And the start-stop system, I should mention that. It's a 48-volt mild hybrid system in this car. And the start-stop system is the best I've ever experienced in any car. You don't bother turning it off. I turn it off in every other car. But this thing, you're just wasting your time if you turn it off, because it is absolutely seamless. Don't know if you've actually experienced that, Paul, on there, but I'd urge you
It's a mild hybrid system.
Yeah, exactly. I'd urge you, if you guys down in Melbourne, if you can get in one of these, the new DT, is to just try that start-stop system out, because you will not believe how quick it is and how seamless it is. Brilliant. Yeah. And, of course, you've got the 1500 TRX coming, which is going to be an absolute monster. When that gets here, I don't know how much that's going to be. It's going to be a whole lot more money than this, but they do power, and they do cubic inches very well, these guys, and it'll be interesting to get into that one too.
We'll have to talk to you once you get into that one, Crawf. 100%. Search Ram 1500 at carexpert.com.au for more. Thank you, Tony Crawford.
Thanks very much, guys.
Joe, you teased this a few weeks back, and I think it was actually while you had the cars in the garage. But the comparison now between the Mazda CX-30 and the Ford Focus Active is on the website, ready to read. Why did you decide to put these two up against each other?
Well, sometimes these comparisons happen by chance, because I've managed to book two cars that are sort of worth comparing at the same time, or it requires a little bit of planning. This one was more of a forward planning situation, where I saw that one of them was in the calendar, and so I was like, what can I compare it against and create a cool piece of content? So the Ford Focus Active, for those who don't know, is sort of like a raised crossover styled version of the Ford Focus hatchback. So think of it as kind of like a Subaru XV style thing to the Impreza in that vein. So it's got cladding, it's been jacked up by about 30 millimeters, it's got some unique styling elements, and even though it doesn't offer all-wheel drive, it's still more of a crossover. So hopefully it appeals, well, the pitch is to sort of appeal to someone who might want an SUV but likes the idea of a more car-like drive. And then the Mazda CX-30, despite being a standalone model, is similar sort of thing. It's a raised SUV-styled version of the Mazda 3 hatchback. So that was sort of the premise of it. These two cars, while billed as SUV crossover-style vehicles, they're still very much car-based and car-like cars to drive. And they're both pretty much line ball on pricing. So the Focus Active is $30,990 before on-road costs and options. And the Mazda CX-30 G20 Evolve spec that we had on test is about $31,500. So pretty close on price. So that was the premise behind it. And also, once upon a time, the Mazda 3 and the Ford Focus were two of the top selling small cars. So this is sort of like the modern version or the SUV world version of that comparison that you might have done 10 or so years ago.
Which one felt more like the car like to drive?
Definitely the Ford, because I think they've sort of tuned it to be a very slightly jacked up version of the Focus, and everything's very familiar. It looks and feels the same from behind the wheel. The Focus Active hasn't lost much of that more dynamic, sporty character that we praise the Ford Focus for having. So you hop in it and it sits a little bit lower than the Mazda. It's very direct and responsive through pretty much all the controls. It's got a thrummy three-cylinder engine, which is nice and powerful. It's super darty at the front end. So it really does not feel that different to a normal Focus hatchback. And 30 mils in the big scheme of things is not a huge amount of ground clearance when you're talking like, you know, it rides at like 150 mil above the ground. So it's not really that high in the big scheme of things. But even the Mazda is still pretty car-like when you think about it. But I think it's the way that they've tuned or calibrated the steering and the suspension. It's a little bit more cushy. It's a little bit more, not floaty, but it definitely wafts over bumps a lot more, and it's very refined. So it sort of feels like a bigger, more substantial car in a lot of ways. So from that respect, yeah, definitely the Focus is more car-like.
Yeah, okay. So sometimes when with crossovers, you lose a little bit of room and practicality inside. Is it the case with these two as well?
No. So with the Ford, the interior dimensions are virtually identical to the hatchback. And incidentally, when I ran the numbers, the Focus is actually longer and wider than the Mazda, as well as having a longer wheelbase. So the Focus hatchback is already quite practical. And unlike some crossovers where you sometimes lose or gain some practicality inside, it keeps the same. So it's got a pretty decent boot. It's got a really large back seat compared to a lot of small SUV competitors. But weirdly, it doesn't have things like rear air vents, which the Mazda does have. The Mazda, in fairness, is actually still a little bit more practical than a Mazda 3 hatchback. It doesn't really improve anything from a rear seat perspective. It's still a bit tight. Like, I'm just over 6'1", and having the driver's seat in my driving position, I was probably kneeing the seat in front, so I'd be a very annoying passenger if I was sitting behind myself in that car. But the boot is slightly bigger. So I think a Mazda 3 hatch quotes like 295 litres, which is something ridiculous for a vehicle in that segment. It's almost 200 litres off most competitors. But the CX-30 quotes 317 litres. But let me just find the figure for the Focus because I don't know it off the top of my head. It offers 341 litres, so a little bit more, but it's a bit deeper, a bit more square. So the Mazda, yes, in compared to the Mazda 3 hatchback, is a little bit more practical, but the Focus is pretty much the same.
Okay. Let's talk driving. You mentioned the Focus has a three-cylinder engine. What's the Mazda got?
So the specification that we have is a G20 model. So G20 models have a 2-litre naturally aspirated petrol engine, which is shared with the Mazda 3 as well as a few other models in the Mazda lineup. And it's been an engine that's been around for a while. So there's been a couple of generations of Mazda 3 with this engine. It makes like 114 kilowatts and 200 newton metres. That's compared to the Focus Active's 134 kilowatts and 240 newton metres. And what's also worth noting there is that because the Focus is turbocharged, it makes its peak torque a lot earlier. So you get all 240 newton meters available from just 1750 RPM, whereas the Mazda, you have to rev it out to about 4000 RPM, which by that point, it's making a lot of noise and sort of making a bit of a fuss. So yeah, the main difference between these two, as I sort of noted earlier, is that the Focus is quite sporty and car-like, or more car-like than the Mazda, whereas Mazda's really tried to give it a very like premium, not numb, but like more effortless and light feel. So in terms of the suspension, the steering, the throttle calibration, it sort of just gets along and it accelerates smoothly, very linear. The rev happy nature of the engine means that you can sort of, the input, what you put in via the accelerator or the steering wheel sort of comes back to you in terms of output in how you would expect it. Whereas, you know, sometimes with turbocharged cars or, you know, ones that have really quick steering ratios, they can be almost over eager to respond to your inputs. Not that the focus is really like that. It's just the focus, everything, as soon as you touch it, it's going. As soon as you put a little bit of lock in the steering, it starts moving. Whereas the Mazda, very progressive, very fluid, and quite relaxing. I feel like you could spend a lot of time in the Mazda and be quite comfortable, and you're very isolated from things like noise or bumps in the road and that kind of thing, and vibration. Whereas the Focus, you sort of feel a little bit more through the steering wheel, through the seat. You'll pick up bumps a little bit harder. You know the steering, you feel a little bit more as you go through corners and things like that. So not that it's tiring, but it's sort of just down to the character. So yeah. I sort of said in the comparison that if you're looking for a more SUV driving experience, but sort of like the car, a bit of a lower driving position, that kind of thing, the Mazda is really nice in that it feels like a much bigger car. It's very settled, it's very comfortable, very quiet. Almost feels like a luxury car in a lot of ways. The interior is lovely. All the touch points are really high quality. The seats are really, really nice and shapely and offer plenty of adjustment. It's one of the few cars that I've tested actually that has like a manual adjustment for the angle of the seat base, which not a lot of cars have, especially at that price point. Whereas the Focus is sort of like, if you really like the Focus hatchback, but you want something with a higher hit point, or you want something that's a little bit more sporty, that would probably be the way to go, because there's pretty much no other vehicle in that small SUV class that has that level of performance as well as that sort of more engaged feel. Like even the Puma with the smaller one liter engine is nowhere near as good. And it's based on the Fiesta anyway, so it's got a less sophisticated rear suspension setup. So the Focus is a better all-rounder. So it was a pretty close comparison. It's more down to like what you prefer.
Mm. We should talk about servicing. How do the service intervals and the costs compare?
So both of them have 5-year warranties, but there's a little bit of a difference in terms of the service cost. So Ford's got a pretty sharp cap price servicing program where the first 5 services are $299 for the first 4 and then $350 for the fifth, which totals just over $1,500 for that same period, covering 60 months or 75,000 kilometres or 5 years, whereas the CX-30's service intervals are a little bit shorter at 12 months or 10,000 kilometres, and the first 5 services cost $316 on every first, third and fifth, and then $361 for the second and fourth. So it's $1,670 for 60 months or 50,000 kilometres. So they're fairly close, but the Mazda actually will cost you more, which is probably something that people don't realise, that a lot of these Asian brands, we're finding with the Japanese and the Koreans that the service pricing is actually getting quite expensive now. And companies like Ford or Toyota and Volkswagen have actually brought down their prices to make them really, really competitive. So over a 3 to 5 year period, you're paying about the same amount of money, plus you've got longer intervals. Not a huge amount of difference, but maybe a surprising one for people who might think that the Ford as a German made car, which is probably another thing they don't realize, is actually cheaper to maintain.
Okay. Well, for those who haven't read the comparison up at the website, who won?
I tried to sort of go with it. There's no real winner. Both of them are winners in their own way, because some people might like the sporty, more engaged feel of the Focus, and then some might also like the more luxurious, comfortable feel of the Mazda. But I guess based against our scoring criteria and sort of like an all-around holistic perspective, the Focus edged ahead by 0.1 of a point. That doesn't really make sense. But you know what I mean? Yeah, it was, I think it was like 8.4 versus 8.3, so very, very close. And I guess if Mazda offered the 2.5-litre engine in this specification, that would be probably much more competitive and maybe would close the gap even more. And I guess the other thing that I would say to people is that, you know, the normal hatchback versions of both of these cars are cheaper, probably even more fun to drive, and also worth your consideration if you don't need a crossover.
Which one would you buy?
I think in this spec, I probably wouldn't buy either of them. The Focus for me, there's too many features that we miss out in our market, which I sort of covered in my Focus ST line hatch review. There's a lot of features that the European market gets out of the same factory that we don't, which would sort of be like, you know, I want nicer headlights, I want bigger wheels, I want, you know, digital instrument cluster, those kind of things. And then with the Mazda, I'd probably be looking at a 2.5-liter model anyway, not the 2-liter, because I think I do a lot of freeway and country driving, so I'd want something that would be more capable at 100 kilometers an hour. But I think between the two of them, I probably preferred the interior and the comfort of the Mazda for daily commuting, going to and from work for that week. The Focus was fun, but you can't really explore its limits until you get onto a twisty back road. So, yeah, tough one.
Hmm. Indeed. That comparison is at carexpert.com.au right now. Go check it out. There goes another Car Expert podcast. Actually, number 50. I should have mentioned this in the intro.
Wow. Yeah. There you go.
50 podcasts down. Wow. Now, what sort of cars have we got coming up in the garage next week?
In Melbourne, we have the updated Kia Cerato S hatchback, which will be good because the launch was in Sydney and we haven't really been able to get one of the new ones through the office just yet. We'll also have a Volvo XC90 plug-in hybrid, so that'll be another good one to have. And we're also running a comparison between the Ford Escape Vignale all-wheel drive and the Volkswagen Tiguan 162 TSI Elegance. Or elegance, however you want to pronounce that. In Sydney, we have the BMW 530e plug-in hybrid, and in Brisbane, we're going to be in a Mazda 6 Sport as well as a Hyundai Santa Fe Highlander diesel. So the Brisbane team will be getting across the top spec Santa Fe that we had in Melbourne not too long ago. How about launches, Paul, now that it's your turn?
Okay, thank you. Well, this week we had technically, yeah, this week, the weeks are just flying by. We had the EQA 250 that you drove, James. We've got a GWM event that Moco went to, and there's some interesting stuff that's going to come out of that. So you'll be able to hear and read about that soon. Next week, we're also checking out the new Nissan Navara Warrior and the MX-30 electric as well. So it is actually pretty busy at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
Certainly
now that
is.
We're all systems are blazing in Melbourne.
For the moment. Yeah.
For the next 10 minutes.
Oh, God. Don't jinx us, Paul. anything on the site that you'd like to highlight?
Well, the two launch briefings that you spoke about that happened the week just gone, the content will be going live on the Friday before this podcast goes live. So there's some really exciting announcements out of Cupra, the new Volkswagen Group subsidiary that hails from the part of Spain that my mother's family is from. So they've got a new line of performance vehicles that will be launching in Australia next year. So have a read of the site for those. And then Great Wall Motors, or GWM, also has a big product rollout strategy that Mike Costello has covered in very extensive detail in the news section as well. So I would recommend having a look at all of those, because some really interesting products come into the Australian market over the next 12 to 18 months.
Exciting times ahead. Paul Marrick and James Wong, thank you.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thank you, Mandy.